reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, chapter 1, chapter 7, verse 47. Ma
rodit
asya
janani
gautami
pati devata
yataham
amrata
vatsata
rodimi
asro
muki
moho
ma rodit
asya janani
Gautami
Patidevata
Yataha
Mrita
Vatsayata
Arodimyasru
Mukhi Moro
Marodidasya
Janani
Gautami Patidevata
Yataha
Mrita
Vatsayata
Rodyamasrumuki
muhu.
Ma,
do not,
Rodi,
make cry.
Asya,
his,
Janani,
mother,
Gautami,
wife of
Drona,
Pati
Devata,
chaste.
Yata,
as,
aham,
myself,
Amrita
Vatsa,
one whose child
is dead,
Arta,
distressed,
Rodini,
crying,
Asrumuki,
tears
in the eyes,
Mohu,
constantly.
Translation,
my Lord, do not
make the wife of
Dronacharya
cry like me.
I am aggrieved
for the death of my
sons.
She need not
cry
constantly like me.
Purport,
sympathetic,
a good lady
as she was,
Srimati
Draupadi did not
want
to put
the wife of
Dronacharya
in the same position
of childlessness,
both
from the point of view
of motherly
feelings
and
from the
respectable position
held
by
the wife of
Dronacharya.
Text
48. If
the kingly
administrative order,
being
unrestricted
in sense control,
offends
the Brahman order
and
enrages them,
then
the fire
of
that rage
burns up
the whole body
of the royal
family and
brings grief
upon all.
Purport,
the Brahman order of
society or the
spiritually advanced
caste or
community and the
members of such
highly elevated
families
were always
held in
great esteem
by the other
subordinate
castes,
namely the
administrative kingly
order, the mercantile
order,
and the laborers.
Here
we find
Draupadi
ends her
plea
by
identifying
her own grief.
And she
did not want
the wife
of Drona
to suffer the
same fate.
There are,
of course, some differences.
One
is that
Asvatthama
is actually
the killer of
her sons.
And secondly,
the sons
were
defenseless,
sleeping.
And
they were
young children.
And
Asvatthama was
an adult.
And he
did so
in full
knowledge
that this was a dharma.
She
has a right to,
in one sense,
to be angry
and
to grieve for
the death of her sons.
And
on the other
hand, the death
of Asvatthama
is
a death
of an adult
who
has
fought
with adults
and
lost.
So
it's a,
and
he should be
punished for
his crime.
So
the sons
of Draupadi
didn't have
any crime,
and
they were killed,
and
Asvatthama
is about to be
killed
because of
his crimes.
So it's a little
bit different,
actually.
Yet,
Draupadi is
in this position.
I do not want
to see the
mother
suffer like
I suffer.
So
this would indicate
her great
compassion,
even if
we would say from
one point of view it
is quite unreasonable
that
she would be so
compassionate
to
equate the two,
because they're very
different situations.
Still, as a mother, she has a feeling for her sons and also compassion for another mother. So, therefore, she pleads for the life of Asvatthama. The other point made here is that the whole family will fall into difficulty because of disrespecting the Brahmanas. So this point is often made in the Bhagavatam. We see, for instance, the case of Parikshit offending the Brahmana and then getting cursed by him. And he did not want to counteract the curse, even though he could do so, because he wanted to make sure the Brahman gets proper respect, and even though he was not a very qualified Brahmana, still, he wanted to make sure that the Kshatriya order would be respectable to the Brahmanas, so he didn't oppose the curse of the Brahmana's son, and therefore he was to die in 7 days. So, we'll find many instances of this, and Krishna himself, of course, is very respectful to the Brahmanas. For instance, in the case of Sudama, who came to his palace, and he put him on his seat, and he worshipped him, and he had his queens worship him also. And in spite of the fact that he was dressed poorly, you know, and had some torn clothing on, and all the gift he could offer was a little bit of chipped rice, still, Krishna was being very, very respectful to him. And, of course, we see that when Narada Muni came to visit Krishna in Dwarka, immediately Krishna got up from his seat and he seated Narada Muni, the great sage, and he began worshipping him. So under normal cases, the Kshatriya has to give great respect to the Brahmin community. On the other hand, the Kshatriyas are supposed to keep order in society, so if the Brahmins go astray, then what are the Kshatriyas supposed to do? They have to do something also. They would have to do something to discipline Brahmanas also. The reverence is always there, so they treat them very carefully. And this is a symptom of that, where she said, well, if we do something to the Brahmins, then they will curse us or whatever, and just the fact that we have offended the Brahmin community will have a bad effect upon our family, and we will be destroyed because of this. So in other words, Kshatriyas have to be very discreet. Even if they want to punish an erring Brahmana, they would have to be very, very discreet in doing so. So this is etiquette followed in the Varnashramic society to make sure that the Kshatriyas do not overstep their boundary of control and use their power to exploit others. This, of course, is based upon the analysis of gunas. Kshatriya has a large amount of rajas in his body, in his mind. Passion means that he likes to act, he likes to control, the negative side of it is they like to enjoy. that's a danger, because the Kshatriya in power can exploit others for his own purposes. And that we see. It often happens, as in the case of King Vena. King Vena was so disrespectful to everyone, so selfish, that he didn't care for any dharma at all. And he simply did whatever he wanted, did all sorts of criminal activities just for himself. And it was so intolerable that then the Brahmins decided they had to get rid of him, and so they cursed him and he died, which is extraordinary also, because usually the Brahmins don't take such action, but in this case they did, because of his a very, very bad character. So a Kshatriya without sattva is useless. So a real Kshatriya is not just Rajagun. He's a mixture of Rajagun and Sattvagun. And that's the only way a good Kshatriya can rule. So that sattva portion of the Kshatriya allows him to respect the Brahmanas. because the Brahmana is sattvic, so therefore because he has a little sattva, then he will give respect to the Brahmins. He will learn scriptures. He will respect Dharma. Learn the intricacies of Dharma and how to institute it in his kingdom. So if that balance is there, then we have a proper king. If a person is predominantly sattva, then of course he doesn't want to control others. He is satisfied in himself. He doesn't have any ambitions to acquire things in the material world or control others or fight with others or discipline others or anything like that. So though the Brahmana is considered the highest person in society, he can't control anybody and he has no interest in doing so, whereas a Kshatriya does. So therefore that is why the Kshatriya is put in control. But he has to have that sattva there so that his energy is balanced by the Brahmana. So that combination is very good for ruling society, where we have the sense of control and discipline. At the same time, we do have the influence of sattva to make things balanced and prevent exploitation, etc., and bring about sense control. So that is the ideal situation. We see sometimes the other kings, the opposing party, they look very wonderful. For instance, Dronacharya ruled for some time when he got rid of the Pandavas. You know, he ruled. Everyone thought, oh, he looks like a good king. Because in one sense, he was following the rules of Dharma. So a person can do that for some time. And look like he's following everything. And we find other kings also, like Vali Maharaj. He was he had sacrifices and everything, and it looked like he was dharmic as well. So in one sense, they do follow some aspects of Dharma, even these big demons in the scriptures. At the same time, there is something within them which disqualifies them. That is their asuric nature. So they may look like kshatriyas, but actually they are disqualified because they don't actually have the sattva portion, which brings about sense control, etc. So in other words, they will institute aspects of Dharma, but it is self-serving. They will do it so that they can use it for their own purposes. In other words, Vali Maharaj would do sacrifices, or others would do sacrifices and do worship, etc. But they are concerned with their own promotion, advancement, position, etc. So that's why they do these things. It is not done selflessly. So therefore, these other type of kshatriyas who are the asuras, though they may also look like they're accomplishing something, ultimately they are very self-centered and they will exploit everyone for their own purposes. So the real kshatriya has to be there and with a good balance. And beyond that, then the kshatriya lines, which are appointed by the Supreme Lord, are empowered by the Supreme Lord. That is the lines of kings descending from the Manus. They are empowered by the Supreme Lord, which also means that they are devotees of the Lord. So not only are they sattvic and rajasic sattvic, they're also devotees of the Lord, which is even more important. So without the admission of the Lord into the this system, again, it fails. So the Bhagavatam makes the point that Varnashram system is good, but it only has its effect if there's worship of the Lord. So the king obviously has to be there to worship the Lord and institute worship of the Lord. So karma yoga fails if there's no worship of the Lord. So that's why in Bhagavad Gita, you know, there's yajna, you do yajna, you worship the devatas, but you also have to worship Vishnu. Vishnu worship has to be there. So that, in that sense, there's some bhakti there. So one of the points of our acharyas is that all these different systems are not independent of bhakti. So karma yoga cannot exist by itself independent of worship of the Lord. If you separate it, then of course it's called Asurik Varnashram or whatever, and you cannot get good results from it. It will fail. And in that system, you try to go to Svargaloka, you cannot even go to Svargaloka. You have to respect the Lord in that system. And the same with Jnana. Well, usually we think of Jnana as simply, the Lord has material body, etc., and then ultimately emerged in Brahman. If one thinks like that, that is offensive to the Lord. And if one is offensive to the Lord, one cannot get liberation. So that is why Bhagavatam says, one who thinks he is liberated, actually is not liberated. And he falls from his position because he does not respect the lotus feet of the Lord. So even a real jnani who gets liberation must respect the Lord. So he cannot think the Lord's body is material. So in other words, the whole of my Vat philosophy, anyone who follows that will not get liberation. Other jnanis, yes. They accept the existence of the Lord. So they can get liberation. Or the yogis, they will accept Paramatma existence and they can get liberation. But if they offend the Lord and think he's a material entity, then no, they cannot get liberation. So therefore, even jnana and yoga are also dependent on bhakti to give the results, that is liberation. And karma yoga is dependent on bhakti in order to give its results, which is svargaloka or brahmaloka or whatever, somewhere in the material world. So they're not independent processes. The whole system is kind of permeated by the Supreme Lord and worship of the Supreme Lord. But we do not call these things bhakti. Why? Because bhakti is a minor portion. It's a little bit. Recognition of the Lord, little worship of the Lord once a year maybe, something like that. But there's something there. So worship of the Lord must be an anga of jnana also. But okay, they respect the Lord. But their goal is to ultimately get liberation. But they have to respect the Lord also. And the Lord will then help them get that liberation. So in other words, without the mercy of the Lord, you can't get liberation. Without the mercy of the Lord, you cannot get Svargaloka or Brahmaloka. You can't just worship the deity and expect them to do it. And liberation, Brahman cannot give you liberation. It's impersonal. The mercy to get liberation comes from the Supreme Lord. He can take you to that state. So therefore, these other processes, they may look like they give results, but actually it is Supreme Lord giving the results. So in Karma Yoga, the results are given by the Supreme Lord, and liberation and in Jnana and Astanga Yoga are given by the Supreme Lord also. So none of these processes are going to be separated from bhakti. Bhakti, on the other hand, is independent of the other processes. So we don't have to mix everything with bhakti. In order to do bhakti, we have to do Karma Yoga, or we have to do Jnana or Astanga Yoga. It can operate independently. And the reason is that these other processes are actually in the gunas. Karma Yoga is basically Rajagun. And when we do Nishkama Karma Yoga, it approaches Sattvagun. Jnana and Yoga are in Sattvagun. That is stated directly that Jnana is Sattvic in the 11th canto. Krishna speaks to Uddhava and he says there that Jnana actually is only Sattva. And knowledge of I am not the body, I am Atma, that Atma Jnana is Sattva realization. So Jnana is also a Sattvic process. It's part of the modes of nature, the process. The process of bhakti is not Sattva Rajatama. It's nothing. It's nirguna. It's beyond the gunas. Why? Because bhakti is part of Krishna. It is his Sarup Shakti. Part of his Sarup Shakti is completely different. Jnana and yoga and karma are not part of Krishna's Sarup Shakti. They're part of the gunas of material nature, which means part of the Achit Shakti. But useful. By the mercy of the Lord, they can do things. So therefore, you can have a happy material life through karma yoga and all that, or you can get to Svargaloka or Brahmaloka. Or you can get liberation also with the help of the Lord through the sattvic processes of jnana and astanga yoga. So they're useful to some degree, but they're actually in the gunas. Bhakti is not in the gunas. It is beyond the gunas. And it's only with the help of bhakti that these other processes work and give their results. So we can mix them also, but actually Krishna prefers the unmixed version. He said, this devotee is the dearest to me, the one who does pure bhakti. So we can also approach Krishna and have mixed bhakti, you know, Archa Jagasa Arti Gyani Chao, but actually the best one is the person who is doing pure bhakti without a mixture at all. So the lesson to learn is that any of these processes independently does nothing. They do nothing. They also have to have a little bhakti in them. When that bhakti becomes more and more and more and more and more until it is prominent, then we'll have a type of mixed bhakti where the bhakti is there prominently and the other things are there in a minor portion. And then it becomes bhakti, but it is mixed bhakti. Karma Misra Bhakti, Gyan Misra Bhakti, or Astanga Yoga Misra Bhakti. There's a still a tinge or influence of these processes in your bhakti also. So that's better than Gyana, Karma, Yoga, etc. So the results are better also. So by Karma Yoga, you can get good material position. By Jnana and Yoga, you get liberation. So then, what does Karma Misra Bhakti or Gyan Misra Bhakti give? It must give you better than Svargaloka and Brahmaloka, and it must give you something better than liberation. Even mixed bhakti. So therefore, Vishnu Chakravarti says, yes, those people who continue to do mixed bhakti and never change, and then ultimately the Lord is merciful to them, and they go to the spiritual world, they go to Vaikuntha. But then we'll say, well then, why we should do pure bhakti? Let's just do mixed bhakti, you know, we'll do our mixed bhakti and ask Krishna for things and everything. But we see in Nectar Devotion, Rupa Goswami doesn't even mention these processes. He rejects them. He says, Anya Abhilashi Dasunya, there's no other desire. It's only pure bhakti you should have. Why? Because it's only the pure bhakti that gets you Rasamrita Sindhu. The ocean of rasa is attained by pure bhakti. So what that means, you can go to Vaikuntha and not have an ocean of rasa. You cannot have rasa also. You can go and have a very weak relationship with the Lord, which we don't really consider to be rasa. Lower part of Shantarasa, and not even that, whatever. So you can go to the spiritual world, you can get Sarupya, Salokya, Sarsti, spiritual body, spiritual planet, powers, I'll live very peacefully, nicely, meditate on the Supreme Lord also, but no service, very little service, very little relationship with the Lord. So the Lord blesses these people because they have a relationship with the Lord, so they get a result, but it is not an intense relationship. And therefore, rasa does not develop for them. So they're there in the spiritual world with a weak relationship with the Lord, and they're very happy. So the Gyani gets Shantarasa as a result because he wants to be peaceful and get a peace, some peace influence in his bhakti. So he gets that. Whereas we'll find those in higher rasas like Mother Yasoda or the gopis, they're not peaceful. And the gopis get very disturbed when Krishna leaves for Mathura, and the gopis, they become mad. And it's completely opposite of Shanta. And Mother Yasoda, when she sees Krishna, you know, when Putana's there, you know, then Putana expands her body, and then Mother Yasoda faints. So she's not Shanta at all. So those in the higher rasas actually have very disturbing relationship with Krishna. So one who is in a Gyani influenced bhakta, he wouldn't like something like that. He has a very peaceful relationship with Krishna. So that's what he gets in the spiritual world. Gyan Rasa Bhakta, very Shantarasa, very peaceful. He can be a sage in the spiritual world and be peaceful all the time. So therefore, pure bhakti is that it gives something higher than mixed bhakti. Yes, mixed bhakti is better than jnana and yoga and karma, and you get better results, but pure bhakti gives higher than that. That is direct relationships of rasa with the Lord and dasya sakya vatsalya madhurya. So that is why Rupa Goswami gives a definition of pure bhakti there. No other desires. Not covered by jnana and karma and yoga or anything else. That will lead to the rasas. So, why do we want the rasas? The rasas are there because they produce the ananda. Now, of course, we are not supposed to be interested in getting bliss for ourselves. Our interest is to give bliss to the Supreme Lord. But the result of that, of course, is that the Lord gives bliss to us also. So in other words, the highest expression of bliss is that relationship of rasa. So if we want to give bliss to the Lord, then we have to establish that type of relationship. That will attract the Lord more, and he will become very happy, and then he will also give bliss to the devotee. So the bliss is two persons, Krishna and the devotee. And that's the manifestation of the Lord's ananda. The Lord is very happy with that, and he produces ananda in the devotee. Therefore, the pure bhakti is the process. So that actually arises from Krishna. He has his hladi and sambit shaktis, and they manifest within the jiva, in bhava and prema. And this allows the jiva to get these experiences of rasa and prema, because they got part of the Lord, and the Lord Shakti, the Chit Shakti of the Lord, has entered into the jiva and develops nicely in prema, and then the devotee can experience everything in spiritual world in relation to the Lord. So pure bhakti is the method of doing that. So here we see in the material world there are often examples of extreme emotions, even more than the spiritual world. So there's no extended separation like Krishna leaving Mathura and then going to Dwarka, and for some years he stays away, and then only after some time they meet in Kurukshetra. We don't have that pastime in the spiritual world. Krishna may disappear for a few hours, but he's always in Vrindavan somewhere. So therefore the extended separation of Krishna from his devotees. Also in Dwarka, he sometimes goes to Hastinapur, so he separates, or to Indraprastha, and he leaves there, and then the people in Dwarka are also separated from Krishna. So such extended separation does not occur in the spiritual world, in Dwarka, in the spiritual world, or in Vrindavan. So in the material world pastimes, we find more extreme emotions, because it's in separation that the rasas become more intense. So that is why we often hear the word viparlamba rasa in relation to madhurya rasa, the mood of love and separation. And Lord Chaitanya experienced that in Puri, and therefore he went into very great extreme conditions of ecstasy. So it's described there how they would find him in the middle of the night, and his limbs separated from the body, and only some skin was holding them together because of the intense feelings of separation. And they wake him up, and suddenly his body would come back together again. So he had these extreme symptoms. Why? Because he was, of course, in the mood of Radha and separation, in intense separation. So that viparlamba often gives this great intense feelings of love, much higher than is experienced in the spiritual world. So that's why some of the acharyas say that the pastimes of the Supreme Lord are superior to the pastimes in the spiritual world because of some differences like that, where there's a variety in lila. Krishna has different ages. Krishna separates, and then that intense separation brings about a greater joy when they unite. So though these it looks like because of this intense feeling, it looks as if the devotees are suffering. As we see here also, Draupadi is crying and whatever because of the loss of her sons. So it often looks like there is all sorts of emotions that look like material emotions. And of course the Gyanis don't like that at all. They don't want to have this, sukha-dukha type of thing. So that's why they want something very peaceful. And they would prefer that in the spiritual world also. And with the devotees, we find, no, they're not peaceful. It looks like they have sukha-dukha also. But actually, it is not the same as the material fluctuations of happiness and distress. All these are part of rasa, part of the bliss. So that intense separation and looks like grief, because when Krishna goes to Vrindavan, they all faint in grief, all the Vrajavasis, but it is not grief in the same sense as material grief. Why? It's because this is an arrangement of the Supreme Lord, and eventually the Lord meets the devotee again, and then they become even more blissful. So it's an aspect of the bliss. The separation is an aspect to create more bliss in the spiritual world. So our acharyas always say that though there is separation, there is also meeting. The Lord never separates and disappears completely. He always comes back. And when He comes back, then there is even greater joy. So that everything is resolved that way. Actually, there is a... though Krishna went away... externally, at least, our acharyas make the point that He did come back, because He promised to come back, and He cannot break His promise to the highest devotees. So though He left, and it appears He didn't come back, He actually did come back. So they quote from the Padma Purana, it says after He killed Dantavakra, then He returned to Vrindavan. And of course the whole of Gopu Champu's purpose is to show that Krishna keeps that promise and He comes back to Vrindavan, and then He stays eternally with the devotees there. And in another form, He goes back to Dwarka. So He has two forms, in Dwarka and in Vrindavan, where He unites with the devotees again there. But of course, we can always criticize, well, Krishna, yes, He came back, but He didn't keep His promise, because He'll come back in 2 months or 3 months. And he came back after years and years and years. So how do we resolve that? So Vishnu Chakravarti says, it is, yes, Krishna cannot break that promise either. So He did come back after 3 months. But we don't see it. So in uppercut form, Krishna came back. Huh? But then we'll say, well, what look, we see the inhabitants are there and they're all suffering, and they kept on suffering for years and years and years, and they had to go meet Krishna, etc. And even after that, they had to wait. So it doesn't look like He came back. So He explains that actually there's two forms of Rajavasis. The ones we see are the separation ones, who had to wait until after Kurukshetra. The other is there also, and Krishna came back, and He's with them. After 3 months, He came back, and then they're all joyful, everything like that, and they're going on with their pastimes together like that, because He has to keep His promise to them. So there are two forms of Rajavasis, and there were two Krishnas also. One Krishna in Vrindavan, one Krishna going to Mathura and Dwarka. Two sets of Vrajavasis, one in separation, which we see, the one we normally see, and another united with Krishna when He came back after 3 months. So in this way, He resolves the issue of Krishna's promise, that actually He kept His promise, but we don't see that part of His pastimes. So, therefore, though, it looks like there is disturbance within the higher rasas, not like the peace of Shantarasa, still, everything is there for a purpose, and those incidents of separation resolve by finally meeting Krishna, and then the bliss becomes even greater. So that is what happens in higher rasas. We have variations like this that look like, you know, happiness is stress, but actually it's all part of rasa. So we see in rasa itself, the secondary rasas involve things like, piti karuna rasa. Feeling miserable and whatever like that. And we have the Vyabhachari Bhavas, which are all sorts of emotions are there also. Those are not the main thing. Those are all secondary things. The main is the Stai Bhava. That is the main thing, like your Madhurya Rasa or Sakya Rasa. And within that, we get these little variations which create variety within that rasa and create more bliss. So all these Leelas are there to produce these different emotions. It's only together that they make rasa. In other words, Stai Bhava itself is not rasa. And the Madhurya Bhava itself is not rasa, the Stai Bhava. It mixes with the other elements, like the Vyabhachari Bhavas and the Sattvika Bhavas, etc., and secondary rasas. And then that produces rasa, which is always changing also. And that's why it becomes rasa, because it keeps changing. So therefore, the devotees in the material world, sometimes it looks like they're experiencing all these strange emotions. It looks like they're material almost, but actually it is only part of the Krishna's plan to produce more rasa for the devotees.
Okay. Question.
Kaviraj Goswami, he explains Mahaprabhu's appearance as Braja Pranjita. He's going to give this type of pran to everybody. Mm-hmm. Now, what if your swarup is some Vaikuntha bhav, and then you can give your swarup?
His what?
Your swarup is a Vaikuntha.
Uh-huh.
And then you come in contact with the Sankirtan and Mahaprabhu, and that means you go to Braja.
Not necessarily. We see, for instance, in Srirango, Lord Chaitanya was with the Sri Vaishnavas for 4 months. One of them changed, Gopal Bhatta, the others, and I think Prabodhan and Saraswati became devotees, but the others remained. Venkat Bhatta remained the Sri Vaishnava, in spite of the mercy for 4 months of personal association with Lord Chaitanya. So if they have a fixed type of relationship, then generally they won't change. But we see that some may not be fixed and they do change, like Gopal Bhatta or whatever, he became a great devotee. So it is possible also they can change, some of them. Of course, we cannot assume that maybe they were not so fixed in the sadhana as Venkat Bhatta, so therefore, you know, they became inspired by Lord Chaitanya, it was easier for them to change. But once it gets very fixed, it's very difficult to change.
Well, that's in the case that they're already practicing their sadhana, but what about the Vaikuntha bhav, Vaikuntha prana, and you become conditioned, and then you get preached to by Mahaprabhu's followers.
Uh-huh.
So then you practice Mahaprabhu's sadhana, then...
Well, if they had, but that means they would have practiced also, if they have that bhava. But generally they say that whatever you practice, that becomes your bhava. That's mentioned in Baladev's, in the Brahma Sutras, about how you develop your relationship. So he says, generally through practice, when it becomes strong, very strong, then it becomes almost permanent. But he mentions this because actually you could change, because in the spiritual world, you have the satya sankalpa ability, which is mentioned in the Upanishads, which means you can desire anything. So you can desire any form and have any form. So you could be a tree, you could be a peacock, you could be a cow, you could be a gopi, whatever. You could do that, that's theoretically possible. But he says for staunch devotees, they choose one form of the Lord and they develop a particular relationship which they really cherish, and therefore their particular form would correspond to that particular relationship. And so they would take that as an eternal form. And that is cultivated by sadhana, whatever they choose when they're doing sadhana in the material world. And that progresses to bhava and then into prema. And it becomes more and more intense, that particular relationship. And therefore, their form also, or their vigraha in the spiritual world will be corresponding to that through their sadhana.